And the topic of the talk, as was already implied by the title, are BPS particles in 4D, n equals to 2 quantum field theories. And I'm going to start gently with a little bit of review to work ourselves up to the statement that we'll try to prove, and then we'll try to give an argument for it. So the statement that we're talking about, that n equals to 2 quantum field theory, is embodied in the algebra of supercharges. This is the well-known n equals to 2 supersymmetry algebra. And in a non-conformal n equals to 2 theory, we are famously allowed to add a complex central charge z that appears in the QQ commutator. Z is a standard scalar charge, which can act on local operators and particles, but it commutes with all the supercharges. And it's complex. And I will denote its complex conjugate by z bar. Throughout, I will denote Hermitian conjugation by bars, in case that's confusing. And the hermeticity condition for the supercharges is such that taking the bar lowers the SU2 index. So at this point, I haven't even said anything about the R symmetry, and this index I, which runs from 1 to 2, is just some automorphism index which keeps track of the fact that we have two supercharges. And most importantly for this talk, as is already clear by the dagger, I'll be working in Lorentzian signature, and that'll be very important at various points. Good. Now, the algebra, the n equals 2 algebra of charges, admits a variety of interesting automorphisms. In particular, it admits two interesting outer automorphisms. There's the SU2R, under which I is a doublet index. And there's the U1R, under which I will take Q to have charge minus 1, and Q bar will therefore have charge plus 1. And from that, we also see that the central charge necessarily carries U1R charge. And in general, neither the SU2R nor the U1R need to be symmetries of the theory that we're discussing. Or even if they are symmetries of the quantum field theory, they may be broken in any given vacuum that we look at. So from the point of view of the algebra, we cannot say much more than that. The only situation where we're absolutely sure that we must have both an SU2R and a U1R is if the theory is actually conformal and we're sitting in the conformal vacuum, because then these R symmetry generators actually appear in the superconformal algebra. Now, in non-conformal n equals to 2 theories, the situation is less clear and it's more case-specific. But in general, it's a good idea to think about non-conformal theories as being obtained by deforming a conformal UV fixed point. So you can imagine starting with some n equals to 2 SCFT, say, in the UV, and somehow deforming it to induce a non-trivial RG flow to some phase in the infrared. And there are a variety of ways you might try to do this. The most canonical way to deform a conformal field theory is to just add a local operator, O, to the Lagrangian. And since we're talking about n equals 2 supersymmetric theories, we would like that operator to be annihilated by all the supersymmetries up to maybe a total derivative. Okay. And if that operator O is relevant, it will trigger a non-trivial RG flow from the conformal fixed point to some infrared phase. All right. Now, if you actually start with an n equals 2 SCFT in the UV, then you can classify, using superconformal representation theory, what these possible O's can be. And they're very restricted. And essentially, they can correspond to the two familiar deformations of n equals to 2 theories that we know from many examples. So the first deformation that you can write involves mass terms. And then n equals to 2 theories, mass terms are in one-to-one correspondence with flavor symmetries. Which are associated with some current J. And the superconformal multiplet that contains the flavor current starts its life with some Lorentz scalar R symmetry triplet that satisfies an interesting shortening condition, namely this one. Okay? So you act with one of the Qs, you totally symmetrize the R symmetry indices, and that is to vanish. Here I'm just writing Q acting on J to mean the commutator of Q on that operator. And then if you use those vanishing conditions to construct the multiplet, you'll find all sorts of interesting operators. At the first level, if you act with Q, you'll find some fermion and its complex conjugate. And if you act again, you'll find an interesting complex scalar K. You'll find the conserved flavor current J. And you can also find the complex conjugate scalar K bar. And then the multiplet ends, by which I mean that if you continue acting with Qs, you'll only generate total derivatives. So that means that this complex scalar here is actually annihilated by Qs up to total derivatives. And that means that it's a good n equals 2 preserving Lorentz scalar operator that you can add to the action and preserve supersymmetry. And just to guide the thinking, if you have a massless free hypermultiplet and you look at one of its flavor currents, then that operator K is a fermion bilinear. So this thing is like a fermion mass term. And that's also clear based on the dimensional analysis. This guy has dimension 2. And since you act with 2 Qs to get to K, K has dimension 3. Okay, so the mass deformation to the Lagrangian looks like M times K plus Hermitian conjugate. And then there are order M squared terms that are induced at higher order that will give rise to the bosonic masses for the hypermultiplet scalars. Okay, good. And you can see just from the way that the doublet indices work out that K is an SU2R singlet. So this deformation is a relevant deformation of an n equals to 2 SCFT that preserves the SU2R symmetry. But you can similarly see that it explicitly breaks U1R. This J is a real operator. It satisfies the following hermeticity condition. And therefore, it has R charge 0. But you act with 2 Qs to get to K. And therefore, K has R charge minus 2. Therefore, this perturbation explicitly breaks the U1R symmetry. OK, good. The other way to induce a non-trivial RG flow starting from an n equals to superconformal theory is to turn on a chiral operator. Let me write that over here, maybe. So a chiral operator is one that's annihilated by all Q bar supercharges. And if you have such an operator, you can add the following term to the Lagrangian. And it's easy to check, just like in n equals 1, that this condition is sufficient to make this supersymmetric. Because up to a total derivative again. Hitting it with Q gives 0, and hitting it with Q bar means that you get to move the Q bar through and annihilate O. Good. And unlike in the flavor symmetry case here, the scaling dimension of this O can be in a whole allowed range, namely between 1 and infinity, based on unitarity bounds. And that means that this perturbation here, since it's obtained by acting with 4 Qs on O, ranges in dimension between 3 and infinity. So you can get relevant, marginal, or irrelevant deformations of this kind. And the only thing that I want to comment on in our context is the fact that whenever you have this deformation being relevant, it also turns out that it has to carry U1R charge. That's because the U1R charge of the chiral operator is related to its scaling dimension, and you can work out the exact R charge of this operator, and you see that whenever the scaling dimension is not equal to 4, this operator breaks the U1R. So again, whenever you induce a non-trivial RG flow away from a UV fixed point, you break the U1R explicitly, and again, just as in the other case, SU2R is preserved. Okay? So those are the two canonical relevant deformations of n equals to 2 SCFTs, and in fact, you can prove that these two options exhaust all possible supersymmetric operator deformations of such theories. There are various other ways you might imagine deforming the theory. For example, you can gauge some flavor symmetry. This again preserves SU2R, but it could break U1R, say, through an anomaly. And finally, a completely different way of deforming the theory is to pass through to its moduli space. This is qualitatively different than the other two deformations, the deformations of type 1 and type 2, were operator deformations that took place in the UV. You can go to a moduli space by dialing the expectation value of scalar fields at spatial infinity, so that's an infrared modification of the theory if you want. But nevertheless, it induces a non-trivial RG flow. And as is well known, the kind of canonical branches of moduli space in n equals 2 theories are Higgs and Coulomb. Coulomb branches are characterized by the expectation value of vector multiplets. These guys are R symmetry neutral, SU2R neutral. They don't have any doublet indices, but they typically spontaneously break the U1R, even if it hadn't been explicitly broken to begin with. So this one has SU2R. And on the Higgs branch, vacua are parametrized by expectation value of hypermultiplet scalars, massless hypermultiplet scalars, which are SU2R doublets, and therefore there the SU2R is completely broken. Okay, good. So the upshot of this discussion.
Sorry, what happened to SI parameters?
Good, thanks for the question. So it was very important here that I said that these are the only possible deformations of superconformal theories. In fact, you can prove that the FI parameter never arises as a deformation of a UV-complete superconformal theory. So it's a consistent n equals 2 preserving Lagrangian. It explicitly violates SU2R because the FI parameter is an SU2R triplet, but it doesn't show up in this list. So it's not true that any n equals 2 theory has an SU2R symmetry, but the class of n equals 2 theories, for example, that can be obtained as perturbations of fixed points does. Good. So this is really just a bit of background to motivate the idea that the majority of perhaps interesting n equals to 2 theories that we care about actually have an SU2R symmetry microscopically. And moreover, if you look at the Coulomb branch, that R symmetry is unbroken. So that means that if you're sitting in a Coulomb branch vacua, there are charges. There are SU2R charges that annihilate the vacuum, and all operators and all states must be in representations of SU2R. Okay, so it makes sense to ask the question of what is the SU2 representation of a given state or a given operator. And moreover, at low energies on the Coulomb branch, at least at a generic point, the effective field theory is a very weakly coupled Abelian gauge theory, and therefore it makes sense to ask what is the spectrum of single particle states at that point. This is not a question that's sensible at the conformal point, but it's sensible on the Coulomb branch. And so the thing that we're going to discuss in the remainder of this talk are the SU2R representations of single particle states on the Coulomb branch. And predictably, the class of states that we will be able to say something about are the ones that are protected by supersymmetry, which are the BPS states. So we'll get there in a little bit. So let's imagine that I sit at some fixed point on the Coulomb branch. And I also fix some charge superselection sector, say some electromagnetic charge and flavored charge superselection sector. Then at that point, the central charge just becomes a number, which I can evaluate at that point and in that superselection sector. And in general, that number is complex. But because I'm only confining myself to this one sector, I might as well do a U1R outer automorphism rotation to make the central charge real. So I'm going to rotate Z to be real. This doesn't require the U1R to be a symmetry. This is just a matter of convenience, because it makes many of the formulas that I'm going to write easier. And then I would like to ask questions about the single particle states in the sector with the central charge. So I'm going to boost to a rest frame where my single particle state is at rest. I'm only going to discuss massive single particle states. The massless spectrum is just given by the abelian gauge fields on the Coulomb branch. And perhaps at special points, there could be additional massless degrees of freedom. But for the massless states, once you have fixed the momentum to be in the rest frame, the little group that you would want to classify them under includes the SU2 of spatial rotations, call it SU2J, and also the unbroken SU2R symmetry. Okay? So the representation content of these single particle states is going to be some combination of representations of this product groups. And we would like to understand what we can say about the allowed values of these representations. Good. So far, this is all bosonic. So in order to discuss the supermultiplet structure of the single particle representation, it's convenient to introduce the following operators. These are some linear combinations of the Q and Q bar supercharges. Okay, and the notation here is such that alpha denotes an SU2 spin doublet index, and I still denotes the SU2R doublet structure. And then just from the structure of the original supersymmetry algebra, you can show that the A pluses and the A minuses satisfy the following algebra. So A plus commutes with A plus to something proportional to the identity, A minus with A minus, and most importantly, A plus anti-commutes with A minus. Good. And moreover, because we said that the Q bars were the Hermitian conjugates of the Qs, we can determine the hermeticity properties of the As. So roughly speaking, what you find is that A plus minus dagger is plus or minus itself, but with the doublet structure reversed. And if you combine that hermeticity property with this algebra, you derive the famous BPS bound, because the anticommutator of an operator, which is with its Hermitian conjugate, has to be positive definite. You find that the mass has to be bigger than or equal to the absolute value of Z. So this is the BPS bound. We call BPS particles those particles that saturate this bound, and all other particles will be called long. And when you actually have a particle that saturates the bound, let me assume that I have a BPS particle that saturates the bound. We'll take m equals z for concreteness here. We'll discuss the case of negative z a little later. And you just plug back into this formula. What you find is that the A pluses form a nice algebra of raising and lowering generators, which we will exploit heavily. And the A minuses just anti-commute to zero. But because of their hermeticity properties, this actually says that they have to be represented trivially on the entire representation. Okay? So this is the statement that the BPS state is annihilated by half of the Qs. These Qs annihilate every single state in the BPS multiplet. And the A pluses act as raising and lowering generators that relate different states in the same BPS multiplet. Okay? And the way that we construct the multiplet is completely standard. You pick a Clifford vacuum, by which I mean a state that's annihilated by half of the A pluses in its conventional. To pick the state such that the A pluses that try to raise the SU2 rotation, the SU2 spin of the state annihilated. So zero is the highest spin state in the multiplet. And then you use the other operators, the ones that have a lower 2, to construct the multiplet. So for example, you can act with A lower 2 upper 1, and that gives a state that I will call 1. You can act with A plus 2, 2, and that gives a state I will call 2. These have the same spin, because I've lowered with lower 2 in both cases, but they have opposite SU2R weights, because this one has SU2R weight 1, this one has SU2R weight 2. And then the top of the multiplet is obtained by acting with the product, and that I will call 1, 2. Okay? So this Clifford diamond with four states in it is the minimal BPS representation. It's sometimes called a half hypermultiplet representation. The simplest example to keep in mind is just a standard massive free hypermultiplet. And if you just have a free hyper, then the states 1 and 2 just correspond to the two complex scalars in an SU2R doublet. And the states 0 and 1, 2 correspond to the two, roughly speaking, the two spin states of the Dirac fermion in the massive hypermultiplet. So this is good to keep in mind. Now, two comments before I move on. Here I have focused on the BPS particles, and by convention, I chose the particles to have positive z. There are also anti-BPS particles, which have m equal to minus z. Those will be annihilated by all the A pluses. The A pluses will now have the zero on the right-hand side of their commutation relation. And the A minuses will act as the non-trivial raising and lowering generators. And later, we will see how to relate these two multiplets using CPT. And that'll play an important role for reasons that I will explain. And finally, long multiplets that do not saturate this bound have both A pluses and A minuses acting non-trivially as raising and lowering operators. They're not annihilated by any supercharges. And they have twice as many states as this half hypermultiplet. Good. So from this construction of the BPS state starting from a Clifford vacuum, it's clear that algebraically, nothing prevents me from charging the Clifford vacuum using an arbitrary representation of SU2R and SU2J. So from the point of view of representation theory, that gives rise to a BPS particle whose Clifford vacuum transforms in some irreducible representation of SU2R and SU2J. So in general, we can express that by indicating that in addition to being the Clifford vacuum, this guy has some SU2R quantum number, which ranges, say, from minus R to R, and perhaps also some SU2J quantum number, which ranges from minus J to J. And nothing in the discussion changes so far. This is perfectly consistent with everything that we've said. And if we denote the little group representation of highest weights R and J by H, then it is sometimes convenient to write the BPS multiplet as the tensor product of the half hyper, by which I mean this diamond that I wrote over there, tensor with H. OK, good. Right. Now, because the BPS particles are protected by supersymmetry, it's been known for a long time that you can learn all sorts of things about them. They're eminently computable, and there's been a lot of progress in that over the last 2 years. The only thing I want to say about that, without going into a lot of detail, is that the structure of these supersymmetric representations alone shows that there is an index you can compute that counts the BPS particles up to some signs. If I write here, I guess it'll be hard to see, right? So there exists an index, we call it script I, which is defined to be the trace over all one particle states of the following combination of the chemical potential Y weighted by the Cartan of the spin and R symmetry SU2s. And you see that the way that it's defined, there's a relative minus sign between these two, and that's what guarantees that it is an index. So this minus sign is the analog of the minus 1 to the F in the Witten index, and this index is cooked up in precisely such a way that it vanishes on all long single particle representations, but it is non-vanishing on BPS representations. But the price you pay for not knowing about the long representations is that you can only abstractly count BPS representations up to this sign. And again, this is the same phenomenon as is familiar from the Witten index. In general, that index only counts the number of supersymmetric vacua with a sign, and it doesn't necessarily coincide with a total number of vacua. Okay? And the underlying phenomenon is completely analogous. I mean, you might worry that, you know, as you vary the parameters of the theory, the masses and the coupling constants and so forth, some long multiplets will come down, and they could spontaneously hit the BPS bound and fractionate into some short BPS particles. And this is kind of an uncontrollable process, since it involves long multiplets. And therefore you need to choose this particular combination of chemical potentials so that you're essentially blind to that phenomenon. Now, there are experts on the subject in the audience, so I won't belabor too much of the history, but I just wanted to say that by analyzing this quantity and many related quantities in lots of examples, Davide Gaiotto and Greg Moore and Andy Neitzke made a conjecture that this phenomenon that I just described of long multiplets coming down and fractionating into short multiplets never happens, and that this index never needs to utilize the minus sign, because, as they conjectured, all the interesting BPS states have vanishing R3 quantum numbers. And this is a statement that they call the no exotics conjecture. And I will state a version of the conjecture now, but I will be a little bit imprecise, because as we will see, that imprecision is actually built into the conjecture, and its understanding it will be important in what I'll say later. So without trying to be too precise right now, let me state the no exotics conjecture of GMN as follows. The Clifford vacuum, a state I called zero, up there, together with its other labels, is actually an SU2R singlet. I.e., this representation only has an SU2 spin, but no SU2R component. Okay? And they made this conjecture based on a whole bunch of different consistency checks and the very explicit analysis of many examples. And they called putative BPS states for which this is not true. So putative BPS states for which R is not zero, they call them exotic. And this is why this is called the no exotics conjecture. So the statement is that such exotic BPS representations don't actually arise in suitably nice n equals 2 quantum field theories. Okay? And one immediate consequence of this conjecture is that the index script I that I wrote up there is such that the minus y to the R3 drops out. Therefore, there are no more minus signs in the index, and the index just coincides with the SU2 character, which means that it actually counts BPS states. So the veracity of the no-exotics conjecture guarantees that you can use supersymmetric techniques to actually count the physical number of BPS states. And that from a physical point of view, that's good. Counting something without signs is better than counting it with signs. That's, for example, something that plays an absolutely essential role in supersymmetric calculations of black hole entropy. From a more mathematical point of view, this conjecture also has pretty striking consequences. So in many cases where you can compute these BPS indices, they are computed by quantizing some suitable classical moduli space. And depending on the way you set up the problem, this could be a moduli space of monopoles or dions in gauge theory. It could be a quiver quantum mechanics moduli space. It could be a moduli space of sheaves on some Calabi-Yau if you're counting deep brains in string theory. And in those cases, the no-exotic statement is a strong vanishing theorem on the cohomology groups on those moduli spaces. And I'm told that these vanishing theorems are mathematically quite surprising and very non-trivial. So that's all I'm going to say about the implications of the conjecture. I think for the purposes of this talk, I just view it as an interesting problem in quantum field theory to try to understand how one might prove such a result, especially since it has to do with this transition between short and long multiplets, which is something that we might be worried about not being able to say anything about. Okay, so before I launch into that discussion, let me try to summarize the status of the conjecture. In addition to the fact that it's been kind of checked and observed in many examples, there's been a detailed proof in the context of pure SUN gauge theory by Diaconescu et al., and also an extension of that proof using quiver techniques to all pure ADE gauge theories. So in those cases, by Del Zotto and Zen. And in those cases, it has been verified by essentially establishing the relevant vanishing theorems for the moduli spaces involved. So it's a proof by exhaustive computation. So what I want to sketch in the rest of the talk is a direct quantum field theory argument that that is intended to establish the no-exotics conjecture in some generality. And one thing that is kind of basic in this discussion is, you know, we're asking a question of the following type. I have a completely consistent representation of some symmetry algebra, and I'm trying to prove that certain representations are not allowed. How is that even possible in principle? I mean, it's a representation of the algebra, so how could I ever rule it out? And the answer is that representation theory is really about charges. It's about the algebra of charges. But in quantum field theory, charges are induced from local conserved currents. And there's an algebra of currents that underlies the algebra of charges. And current algebra is always more powerful than just the algebra of charges. So for example, the simple dramatic example is the case of current algebras in 2D CFTs. We learn much more from the current algebra than just the global symmetry ward identities. And the argument for no exotics that I'm going to discuss, let's see, I want to keep some of this. Let me. The argument against exotics that I'll discuss is closer in spirit, perhaps, to the Weinberg-Witten theorem about massless particles. Let me briefly remind you what the Weinberg-Witten theorem says. The Weinberg-Witten theorem says the following. Consider a 4D, for simplicity, consider a 4D quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory. Then you know very well that the Poincaré group admits massless single particle representations of any helicity. So from the point of view of representation theory, any value, integral or half integral value of the helicity is allowed. And nevertheless, Weinberg and Witten says that if you have a quantum field theory with a well-defined local conserved stress tensor, T mu nu, then the allowed helicities are at most one. So only scalar spin a half fermions and spin one vector bosons are allowed in quantum field theories with the well-defined stress tensors. Theories with higher spin massless particles exist, such as gravitational theory, supergravity theories, et cetera, but they cannot have a well-defined local stress tensor. And the argument is extremely simple. You just examine the matrix element of the stress tensor between different single particle states like that. So here I have a state of momentum p, a state of momentum p prime, and the momentum transfer going through the stress tensor is p minus p prime. And if you take the forward limit of this matrix element, the forward limit means p going to p prime, then the momentum transfer going through t mu nu is zero, so the ingoing and outgoing momenta are equal. And what this means is that the stress tensor is effectively being integrated over all of space, and you're just measuring the total energy in that state. So that forward limit is fixed by Lorentz invariance to be some expression like that. The two p's are required by Lorentz invariance, and if you actually plug in t 0, 0, this will just pop out a factor of the energy. And in particular, it cannot be 0. OK. And then the second part of the argument is, OK, imagine that you boost the p's to a configuration where the two particles actually look like that. So they collide head on. Right? Since both of them have helicity sigma, it means that the angular momentum of one of them points this way, okay, and the angular momentum of the other one points in the other direction. So in between those two particles, there's actually an angular momentum mismatch of magnitude 2 sigma. But in between those two states sits the stress tensor that only has angular momentum 2. So the only way to get a non-zero matrix element between these two states is if the angular momentum difference is actually less than or equal to 2. Okay? And that establishes the Weinberg-Witten bound. The reason that you don't want this matrix element to vanish is that you can boost back to the forward limit where you have to get this. So there's no way it can be 0. Right. Okay, so this actually introduces one of the main tools that we're going to use in the no-exotics argument. We're just going to examine the matrix element of the R current between BPS states. I'll bring this down. All right. So the idea, basic idea, it's very schematic. Just examine this matrix element. in the Clifford vacuum. This is supposed to be the SU2R current. It's in a triplet of the R symmetry. You might try to prove that this vanishes. And by the same logic as in the Weinberg-Witten case, the forward limit of this matrix element just measures the SU2R charge of the state. Good. And how might you try to prove that this matrix element is zero? Well, roughly speaking, a simple way this could happen is if the R current is actually Q exact. So another thing you might wonder or hope for is that this is in some suitable sense Q exact, where the key information lies in the way in which this is Q exact. Okay? In particular, this Q needs to be one of the Qs that annihilates the BPS state. Okay. So this is the very rough idea. This is what we're going to hunt for. And in order to simplify the discussion for the remainder of the talk and make it tractable for me to present it in the last 20 minutes or so, I'm going to make a few simplifications. The most important simplification is that I'm going to assume that these matrix elements are all finite in the forward limit. And that's something that should justifiably worry you in a Coulomb branch vacuum in which there are massless gauge bosons, because the exchange of massless particles can lead to singularities in the forward limit. And indeed, that's actually what happens if you examine the matrix element of charged of operators between charged BPS states. Okay? So the assumption that all these matrix elements are finite and well-behaved, if you want to say it one way, you can say that you're only looking at the neutral BPS states. Another way of saying it is that perhaps instead of discussing the Coulomb branch problem, we're just sitting in some gapped SU2R preserving vacuum, and we're asking about the properties of BPS states in that vacuum. That sounds like a drastic simplification of the problem, and it is. But it still captures the essential physics input that goes into why the no-exotic conjecture is actually true.
What are neutral BPS states?
Excuse me?
What are neutral BPS states?
Say a mass of hyper.
So look, the central charge
is equal to the mass.
Yeah, but it's still.
So for example, one extremely simple version of the statement is that if I have some n equals 2 theory that flows to some gapped vacuum, then there cannot be some massive hyper in the spin 70,000 representation of the R symmetry. OK. Good. And in fact, the massive hyper is already where we're going to get most of our meat and our intuition. And this is where I'm going to come back a little bit to the way in which the no-exotics conjecture is stated. It's supposed to say that the SU2R charge of the Clifford vacuum is zero. But we have to ask which SU2R symmetry we were talking about. And unlike the case of a conformal field theory where there's a canonical SU2R symmetry that's handed to you from the algebra, in some massive theory, there's no longer a canonical choice of SU2R. And just to illustrate this point, it suffices to look at a massive hyper again. I guess I'm going to keep going here. OK. So the standard hyper is the one where the scalars are SU2R doublets. And then you act with the supersymmetry ones, and you get fermions that are SU2R singlets. This is supposed to be reflected in the statement of the conjecture. But this is always true. So we want to use that R symmetry. But the problem is that R symmetry is not so easy to quantify unambiguously. For example, imagine that the hypermultiplet also is charged under some SU2 flavor symmetry. Okay, and let me call capital A some SU2 flavor index, doublet index. That's perfectly fine. That's perfectly possible. Just take a bunch of hypers. They have some flavor symmetry. Now, if you define a new R symmetry, SU2R twiddle, to be the diagonal SU2 inside the original R symmetry and this SU2 flavor symmetry, then what you're going to make what you're going to make is you're going to identify this index and that index. So you're going to make a hypermultiplet where the scalars have two R symmetry indices and the fermion is an R symmetry doublet, or maybe I should say an SU2 R tilde doublet. Okay. So from the point of view of the SU2 R tilde symmetry, this is an exotic BPS day. Okay. And it was trivial to make it just by doing this rearrangement by the flavor symmetry. So somehow what we need to say is how the no exotics conjecture picks out the SU2R symmetry versus the SU2R tilde symmetry. And from the point of view of the algebra of charges, they're completely identical. Right? This is as good an R symmetry as the original one. The supercharges are still doublets. There's algebraically no problem. And again, what will save us is the fact that the charges are induced by currents. So the SU2R symmetry has a current J. Right? The SU2R tilde symmetry has a current which I'll call J tilde. And one way you can distinguish them is to ask which supersymmetry multiplet do the currents J and J tilde reside in? Okay? This is a Poincaré supersymmetric theory. All local operators must reside in some multiplet of supersymmetry. And we can ask which. And let me first answer that question for the nice standard SU2R current, and then I'll say a few words about the funny SU2R tilde current. So what this simple free hypermultiplet example teaches us is that J and J tilde reside in structurally distinct Suzy multiplets. Okay? And the nice SU2R current that we would like to prove something about resides in a very well-known multiplet that also contains the stress tensor and the supersymmetry current. And it's sometimes, there are different names for it, but it was first discussed by Sonio, so I'll just call it the Sonio stress tensor multiplet. The Sonius multiplet is kind of the canonical stress tensor multiplet of a non-conformal n equals to 2 quantum field theory. Okay? It starts its life with a real scalar primary, which I will call T, and it satisfies a shortening condition, which looks like this. If you act with two Qs on T, contracted to a Lorentz singlet, and symmetrized to an SU2R triplet, then this thing is some operator xij, where xij satisfies the shortening condition of a current. So the same shortening condition as a flavor current. But in general, x is complex. So it's a complex flavor current. And in fact, the complex current that sits inside x is nothing but the central charge current of the theory, the one that integrates to the Z operator in the charge algebra. Okay? Good. So the multiplet looks something like this. You start with T. Let me draw it like this. You start with T. You act with supersymmetry, you get some spin a half superpartners, which I'll call lambdas. They'll not be particularly important. You act with supercharges again. Here you get x. Here you get x bar. And in the middle, when you act with a q and a q bar, you get the SU2R current. Okay, so the SC2R current is obtained by acting with Q and Q bar on T. And actually what you find is that there are a bunch of other operators in this multiplet. I will not discuss them too much. But for example, at the same level as the SC2R current, there is some vector field or vector operator R mu, which is not conserved in general. And that is the leftover broken U1R current that used to be conserved in the conformal field theory, but is no longer conserved away from the conformal point. If you set x to 0, then you recover the conformal stress tensor multiplet. In that case, this operator vanishes, and this R turns out to be the conserved U1R current. Okay. There are also some other operators here. Let me not dwell on them too much. But one other thing that I wanted to say is that if you go to the next level, you get the supersymmetry currents and ultimately a stress tensor. Okay. So this is the Sonius stress tensor multiplet. And it contains the nice SU2R current that tries to assign doublet indices, a single doublet index to every hypermultiplet and so forth. Okay? So let me say a few words about why this multiplet should be thought of as the kind of canonical stress energy tensor multiplet of a deformed n equals to 2 superconformal theory. So one thing I already said is it tries to assign the standard R charges to hypermultiplets, for instance. If you try to make a Sonius multiplet out of a hypermultiplet, then the only way to do it is to pick the R current to be the one that assigns it a regular doublet index. Another statement, which is important, is that we believe that this multiplet actually exists in any deformed superconformal theory. So if I take an n equals to 2 superconformal theory and deform it either by adding a relevant chiral operator or by adding a mass or by gauging something using, say, an asymptotically free gauge group, all of these deformations are expected to lead to the Sonius multiplet. Yes?
Is there some interpretation in terms of supergravity?
Yes. Yes.
With respect to some?
Sure. Once I give you the stress tensor multiplet, there's a canonical partner supergravity that couples to it. Okay. And the statement that the Sonius multiplet exists means that you get to couple to this particular choice of supergravity fields.
Yes.
Theories that don't have that multiplet, you couldn't couple them to that. For example, a theory with an FI term, which breaks the SU2R, cannot have this multiplet, and it cannot couple to this sort of standard minimal n equals 2 supergravity. Yeah.
What's the meaning of this scalar T?
In a Lagrangian theory, T is something very simple. Like it's just a bilinear of, it's Q squared for hypers and phi squared for vectors and so forth. Just a scalar bilinear. It's just some scalar. It's not a conserved current. It's just there because of the structure of the multiplet.
It's not
No, it's real. It has absolutely no geometric interpretation. It couples to a completely innocuous supergravity field, some auxiliary field. But it's there because of the structure of the multiplet. And it's this multiplet, it's the structure of this multiplet that's ultimately going to imply the no-exotics relation. I'll get to that in half a second. To a vector multiplet, two vector multiplets, because this guy is complex. Typically, to get dynamical supergravity, you need to add even more fields. But just background fields that couple to that, it's enough to just add two vector multiples. Good. OK, let me not mention this. I think it's confusing. So I won't belabor the structure of the supermultiplet that contains the funny SU2R current, the tilde one. It's a much less familiar, much less well-studied multiplet that's pretty ugly. It arises from essentially mixing this Sonius multiplet with some redefined version of an SU2 flavor current multiplet. And it's a really ugly multiplet. You see, this multiplet at least has the nice feature that it has that its highest weight. It starts with something, and you can generate anything else. The other multiplet has two highest weights, which are then fused in the middle. These are atrocities that can happen in non-conformal supersymmetry. But let me not dwell on them here. What I want to explain in the last
several minutes is how the structure of the Sonius multiplet, together with this idea of taking matrix elements, can be used to prove the no-exotic statement, at least in this situation that we are assuming where all the matrix elements are well-defined. And for this, I will need to use formulas that are buried here. These formulas. Okay. You can see from the structure of the Sonius multiplet that I already wrote down there, this extremely naive picture of the R current being Q exact is roughly speaking borne out because it sits at level 2 in the multiplet. So it's Q of something, and it's also Q bar of something. So that's already a good start. Clearly, this idea would be a total non-starter if the SU2R current were actually the bottom component of the multiplet. Good. So let me consider the Clifford vacuum. So the state that I called 0 over there, but in an arbitrary SU2R state. So this is an SU2R index running from minus R to R. OK. I'm going to examine the following matrix element, 1s, t, 2s prime. What do I mean by that? I mean that starting with this Clifford vacuum, I can act with this raising operator to make the state 1 on that Clifford vacuum labeled by S. And similarly, I can make the state 2s prime by taking a different Clifford vacuum, the one with S prime, and acting on it with this raising generator. So I'm considering the matrix element between those two. And I claim that there's a Ward identity that sets this equal to minus 1 over 2m times the matrix element of J0, 2, 2 between the two Clifford vacua. Okay? So these are the two Clifford vacua. J22 is the component of the SU2R current that integrates to R minus, the SU2R lowering generator. Okay? So this thing is proportional to 0s R minus 0s prime. And it's fairly easy to see how you might obtain such a Ward identity. You write this state as some of the A plus is acting on that Clifford vacuum, and the other state as some other A plus acting on this Clifford vacuum. Then you pull the A pluses onto T, and you use the fact that they are linear combinations of Q and Q bar, and this diamond here to re-express them in terms of J. And there are various other supersymmetry relations you use, but you use the structure of the Sonius multiplet and the fact that half of the supercharges annihilate the BPS state. So this is a Ward identity that's true in the BPS state. Unfortunately, it's not enough to establish that this is actually 0. Right? If we could actually prove that this is 0, we would be done. If we can prove that the matrix elements of the lowering generator between any Clifford vacuum are 0, means that the Clifford vacuum actually has vanishing SU2R charge. In order to finish the discussion, we need to use the fact that we're discussing a local quantum field theory. And quantum field theories also have a symmetry called CPT, which relates particles and antiparticles. Okay, so I'm going to denote by theta the CPT transformation. It's an anti-unitary transformation that squares to minus 1 to the f. And very importantly, it has an interesting action on the superchargers. If you act with CPT on the superchargers, you can prove completely model independently that you have to get I times the Q bars. That just follows from the general properties of CPT and the structure of the supersymmetry algebra. Okay? And that I is going to make our day. That I is going to be responsible for all sorts of phases that will then allow us to prove that this matrix element is essentially equal to minus itself. So we're going to chase this relation through a commutative diagram where we act with CPT here, and we act with CPT here. Okay? So for example, if we act with CPT here, we're going to get the matrix elements of the current
with 1-1 index structure, because CPT on the lowering generator gives me the raising generator. So I get the raising generator between the CPT conjugate BPS states. And the CPT conjugate BPS states satisfy different Ward identities than the BPS state because they're annihilated by the other half of the supersymmetry. So if I use the other half of the supersymmetry to derive a similar Ward identity as the one I had up here, then I prove that this thing is actually equal to minus the matrix element of T in between the BPS conjugate 2 and 1 states. Okay? But now I'm in business. Here, I just am left with the action of CPT on the operator T. T is a real operator, and so CPT can at most give it a sign. And moreover, that sign is completely fixed by the structure of the Sonius multiplet and the fact that the supercharges have fixed CPT transformation. The moment I know how the supercharges transform, I know how S transforms. And then I just chase it back to find out how T transforms under CPT. And magically, T is CPT even. Actually, that's not that magical. That's what you would expect from a real scalar. That's a bilinear of complex scalars. So the fact that this guy is CPT even means that this matrix element is equal to minus itself. Okay, and that is enough to establish the result we wanted. Because the moment that this vanishes, you say that the matrix elements of the lowering generator vanish between all states in the Clifford vacuum, and that means it has to be an R-symmetry singlet. Okay, so that is the statement of the absence of exotics for this class of states. And so what I showed, or what I argued, is that the moment you have a Sonius stress tensor multiplet and you also use CPT, importantly, then the no exotic statement holds if you use the R current in that Sonius stress tensor multiplet. What I didn't talk about was how you have to modify the argument in the presence of massless vector fields if you're discussing the most interesting case of charged BPS states on the Coulomb branch. That complicates the argument quite a bit. But as I said before, there are now singularities in these matrix elements as you take the forward limit. But the good news is that the singularities are completely controllable. They're just due to single vector U1 vector boson exchange and in the low energy limit, which is completely controlled by how the U1 vector boson is coupled to charges. So those singular pieces are themselves, again, controlled by current algebra, and they can be determined very generally and very explicitly. The other thing that I wanted to mention briefly is that you could imagine all sorts of extensions of this argument. One is that there's an interesting class of BPS states in 4 dimensions that was also discussed by Gajota-Morinitsky, which are so-called frame BPS states, where you have a line operator defect inserted into your theory, and then you study the BPS states that bind to it. And there's a similar no-exotics conjecture for such states. So you might hope that there's a generalization of this argument that also establishes that version of the conjecture. And finally, the structure of the Sonius multiplet in 4 dimensions is actually very uniform in theories with 8 supercharges in 6, 5, 4, and 3 dimensions. So it would also be interesting to see if similar type of no-exotic statements can be derived analogously in those cases, say in 5D on the Coulomb branch or even in 3D. And there they would make statements about the cohomology groups of instanton moduli spaces or vortex moduli spaces, perhaps. So that's still an open question. So I think I'll stop here, yeah.
Okay, well, let's thank Thomas again for the talk.